for an aperitif, some coffee. She shook her head. But if I'd care to, could I come to her house? I live with my mother at number 11, Rue Emile Zola, is behind the church and down the hill. Huh? She turned to go and called over her shoulder. You come at 4 o'clock, for tea.
Jericho was written and read by Dirk Bogarde. It was abridged by Neville Teller and produced by Janet Whittaker. Part 3 is tomorrow afternoon at 2:30.
Slip on your swimsuit and slap on the sun cream as Radio 4 Extra heads to Brighton to take a trip through the archives with a collection of programmes that celebrate Britain's seaside heritage.
Send in your sandwiches, send in your ears.
Introduced by a host on the coast.
I'm Tony Liddington. And I've been a seaside entertainer for over 30 years.
Where's he taking you then? The Grand Hotel?
It wasn't as dangerous as going abroad and all that funny food and other languages and things.
Who'd have thought? The three of us, eh? Here in a hut on Brighton Beach.
4 Extra at the British Seaside.
Catch up on the Radio 4 Extra website.
You have a lovely day.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Agent Richard Hannay is summoned to the War Office to foil German plans to create a holy war in part one of John Buchan's Greenmantle at 3 o'clock. First, it's part two of The Tent, The Bucket and Me. And the early years of the 1970s continue to unfold a series of disastrous family holidays for Emma Kennedy and her parents. 1972 was the year of the trip to Hadrian's Wall and rather a lot of cross-border matrimonial raids, all of which are doomed to end in tears.
We were heading into unknown waters and the bleak moors of Northumberland. It was another adventure. Dad, as ever, kept us going with regular renditions of that year's holiday song, Alice Cooper's School's Out. My mother, for whom the North was somewhere you only went to in an emergency, like the imminent death of a much-loved relative, had her suspicions that our holiday wasn't going to be another calamity. But at least she'd be visiting her friend from university, and that, and only that, was sweetening the pill. Jenny and Tim lived in a delightful red brick curiosity with a small garden in front and steps up to the front door. "This is nice," said my mother as we stared up at it. And it was, from the outside. The interior was a total tip. Plastic bags filled with lager tins, real ale bottles, clothes, books and newspapers were everywhere. Ashtrays, full to bursting, were balanced on every available surface. Jenny, who had the look of someone past caring, was distracted and drawn. We'd been travelling for 6 hours, and in normal circumstances it would have been reasonable to expect a cup of tea or a glass of squash, followed up with something solid, like an evening meal. "Something's not right," whispered my mother when Jenny left the room to answer the phone. "Let's suggest we go to the pub or something, then we can get something to eat." My father nodded silently. "Tim's on his way," said Jenny, coming back into the kitchen. "I don't know what he's been doing or where he's been." "Is everything all right, Jenny?" asked my mother, moving in to take her hand. Jenny, looking down at my mother's hand in hers, went very quiet and then, with a significant heave of the shoulders, started crying like a wounded animal. "Ooh," said my dad, bundling me out of the room. "Let's go for a little walk."
"Why is Jenny crying?" I asked as we left the house. "Is she upset?"
"I expect so," said my dad, zipping up his jacket with purpose. "I think we should try and find a fish and chip shop, don't you?" Dad decided we would have a quick drive round to see if we could find some shops, but we had barely got to the end of the street before we came to a screeching halt.
Dad, winding down his window, shouted, "Tim!" and waved in the direction of a man with a pipe in his mouth. The man plodded over to us and thrust a hairy arm in through the window to shake my father by the hand. "That Emma?" he asked, pointing his pipe at me. "Haven't you grown? Where are you going?" "Gonna find some fish and chips," explained Dad. "Brenda's with Jenny." "They're having a chat," added my dad, whispering the last bit in man code. Tim stood upright and gave that matter a small think. "Tell you what," began Tim, "you wouldn't mind dropping me off on the way, would you? Just got to drop something off with a colleague, then we can, you know, pick up the chips and come back. It's not far out of the way. If you just take this next left and park up by the second house on the right," Tim said, gesturing with his smoking pipe, "that'll be grand. It won't be long." We had pulled up outside a large 1950s-style semi. From where we were parked, we could see straight into the lounge. A woman with voluminous curly blonde hair had answered the door. And as Tim disappeared inside, I asked who she was. "Someone Tim works with, I think," said Dad, who was staring in the direction of the lounge. Following his eyeline, I turned to look as well. Tim and the woman were now standing in the lounge talking, but as we watched, the woman put her arms round Tim's neck, and right before our very eyes, they started kissing. "Holy smoke," said my dad, gripping the steering wheel. "What the hell's going on here?" "They're kissing, Daddy," I said, by way of explanation. My father, terrified that he had found himself implicated in a marital indiscretion, stared into the lounge with incredulity and slumped his forehead onto the steering wheel. "Why is he kissing that lady?" I asked, still staring. "Is that his job?" But my father didn't answer. Because my father had his head down, I felt duty-bound to provide a running commentary.
"He's stopped kissing now. They're talking. Oh, no, they are kissing now. They've stopped again. I can't see them now. Oh, the front door's open. He's coming, Daddy. He's coming back to the car now."
Tim, far from being bashful or coy, was beaming from ear to ear.
"Ah," he said as he leapt into the car. "That's better. Now then, chips."
Tim blathered on as if nothing untoward had taken place, as my father, head bowed, was ignoring him as best he could. Whichever way you cut it, this was a sticky business, and my dad, who was physically incapable of keeping anything from my mother, knew that he was going to have to squeal like a canary as soon as we got back. I, on the other hand, was just thinking about the chips and tartar sauce, but mostly just about the chips. Mum and Jenny were still in the kitchen, but on hearing us arrive, Mum came out into the hallway. As Tim sauntered off to the kitchen, my mother threw her hands up and rolled her eyes. My father gestured urgently up the stairs. "Brenda, why don't you help me wash Emma's hands?" Bundling us both into the bathroom and locking the door, my father spun on his heels and said, "Brenda, this is awful. You won't believe what we've just seen."
"The jar of eggs was massive," I said, holding my arms out. "It was this big."
"We bumped into Tim," blurted on my dad, ignoring me, "and he asked me to drive him round to this woman's house, and he said he had to drop something off, and I thought it was something to do with work, and he goes in and we can see everything from the car, and he only bloody goes inside and starts kissing her. We saw the whole thing. Emma saw it too, didn't you?"
"Tim was kissing a lady inside the house. Can we have fish and chips now?"
My mother turned, stood up and pointed a very strict finger. "Emma," she began, leaning over me, "you and your father did not see Tim kissing another woman. Do you understand?"
"But I did see them," I replied, not understanding one little bit.
"No," said my mother, in the voice she reserved for cataclysmic occasions, "you did not see them. And if anyone else asks you about it, you just say nothing, or you'll be in a lot of trouble." "Lot of trouble," said my dad in agreement. I looked at my parents. Adults, I was forced to conclude, were quite mad. In retrospect, it was a terrible idea to ask Jenny and Tim to join us on the following day's excursion to Hadrian's Wall. As we left Newcastle, the grumbling day worsened, and by the time we got to Chesterholme,
the skies were heavy and begrudging. Not only that, but it was clear that Jenny and Tim had done nothing but argue from the moment we were out of earshot. Jenny's face was tear-stained, her eyes red and puffy. My mother, flushed with sisterly solidarity, took Jenny by the arm and marched off, telling Tim he was a bastard as she went. Tim, pipe in mouth, popped open the boot of his car, got out 10 bottles of Newcastle brown ale, and then informed my father that he was going to drink the lot and kill myself. Tony decided to concentrate on me. "Let's pretend we're Roman soldiers," he said as we scrambled up a steep bank to walk along the wall. "Is this a Roman wall?" I asked, pointing at it. "Yes," said Tony. "And Roman soldiers used to march along here shouting, 'Sinister Dexter, Sinister Dexter.' That means left, right, you know, like when soldiers are marching. Sinister Dexter, Sinister Dexter." As Dad was speaking, he was striding backwards and forwards as if he were a Roman soldier. "Tony," said a voice behind us, "what are you doing?" It was my mother. She looked anxious. "We're pretending to be Roman soldiers," said Tony, smiling. "Daddy's pretending," I corrected. "I'm not." "This is a nightmare," said my mother with a sigh. "Jenny's in bits. I can't see anything about you know what. It's just awful. Awful." "Where's Tim?" "In the car park, drinking himself into oblivion. I thought it best to leave him to it." "You can't let him do that," said my mother, voice going up a notch. "That'll just make matters worse. Go and get him and walk him round. Jenny's in the loo. I think we should all walk the whole thing off. Calm everyone down." I'd clambered up onto a low part of the wall. Just on the horizon, I could see two figures, an adult and a child, weaving in our direction, but I didn't give them much thought. I was distracted by the crows. Normal birds would flap off if you came anywhere near them. Not this lot. They were defiant and grouchy, hopping about with proprietorial arrogance. "Don't ever get married, Emma," said Jenny as she puffed her way up to us. "Ugh, what horrid crows. They look like undertakers, waiting for us all to die. Oh, what's the point?" "Well," Jenny suddenly, "we're all going to get eaten by crows or maggots or worms." The temperature had dropped and a bruised purple crept across the skyline. Dad, who had somehow managed to persuade Tim not to go down in a blaze of alcoholic glory, was heading towards us along the ridge, Tim in disgruntled tow. I was staring off towards the horizon again. The adult and child had made good progress and were almost in proper view. "Hello," said the woman as she and her daughter approached. "Got cold all of a sudden, hasn't it?" "Yes," said my mother, delighted to be able to chat to someone who wasn't having a nervous breakdown. "I think it's sure to rain. That sky is looking very ominous." As I gazed up at the woman, there was something nagging at the back of my mind. I'd seen her before. "Oh, Christ," said a voice suddenly to our left. It was Tim. "Uncle Tim," shouted the girl, scampering over to him. "Uncle Tim," said Jenny, bewildered. And then I remembered. "Mummy," I shouted, running to my mother, "that's the lady Tim was kissing." "Oh, Christ," said Tim again. Because if there was ever a time that a man needed divine intervention, it was now. My father had his head in his hands. Brenda was standing with her mouth hanging open, and Jenny was striding towards the woman with a raised hand. With the wind howling around them, Jenny slapped the woman full on the cheek. The woman cried out and bent down to her left, clasping her face as she stumbled. Tim, desperate and with anger raging from his eyes, scrambled to the wall, grabbed a loose and hefty rock from its top, and ran at Jenny, arms aloft. My father, realising that murder was about to be committed, leapt at Tim and brought him down with a rugby tackle. We stood dumbstruck as the two of them rolled down the incline and came to an undignified heap at the bottom. "What are you doing?" screamed my father. "Are you mad? That's a bloody heritage site. You can't take rocks out of it and throw them about." "Never mind the bloody wall," yelled Jenny. "He was trying to kill me. And who's this bitch? And what the hell is she doing here?" My mother, sensing that ugly scenes were about to cascade around us, gripped me by the hand. "You come with me, Emma," she said sharply. "Let's go and sit in the car." As I was dragged away, I watched over my shoulder at the ascending crisis.
"He told me you were in a wheelchair," shouted the woman, gesturing pointlessly at Jenny's legs.
"And the lesson for you to learn, Emma," my mother muttered as we tripped over grassy clumps in our haste, "is that men cannot be trusted."
"Even Daddy?" I asked, because that needed to be clarified.
"No, Daddy's all right," said my mother, then added, "but only just."
The Tent, the Bucket and Me was written and read by Emma Kennedy. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters.
This Monday afternoon, a musical adventure brought to life by the Britain Symphonia.
So you'll hear the snow glistening away, you'll hear the reindeer racing across the sky. Have a listen.
A family concert from the BBC Proms, based on John Classen's story, I Want My Hat Back.
Where's my hat? Where's my hat? I had it on my head a moment ago. Where's my hat? Where's my hat? I had it on my head a moment ago.
A musical 4 o'clock show on BBC Radio 4 Extra on Monday afternoon at 4 o'clock.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, this is Jim Lee. Drama next this afternoon. Then on the 4 o'clock show, the sculptor Anthony Gormley takes a walk around Edinburgh to seek out his 6 life-size iron body doubles. And the children's author Anne Fine shares her inheritance books. And there's an Edinburgh special for the panel show that's a bit like Mr and Mrs for Mates later. It's Not What You Know with Miles Jupp in the chair. It's at 10 o'clock in the Comedy Club with the great John Shuttleworth. Now, though, it's the first of a two-part adaptation of John Buchan's Greenmantle, which was published in 1916. During the First World War, Richard Hannay is summoned to the War Office, where he's told of a German plot to start a holy war in the East. If an uprising takes place, it could draw Allied troops away from the European front. So Hannay is charged with foiling their plans.
Oi, you! Get out! Some Arab, sir! Looks like one of their muleteers. He's in a bad way.
Good Lord. Someone didn't like him. How on earth did he get here?
Probably came from Basra, sir. Though how he managed it on foot with all them bullets in him is nothing short of a miracle.
Is he still alive?
Just.
Right. Move him into the shed, give him some water. Nothing more we can do.
Something is coming.
Great Scott! He's English. All right, old fella. You're safe now. Corporal.
Sir.
Fetch the medic, quickly.
Sir.
Captain, this message. Urgent.
All right, old fella. I've got it all. I'll see it gets to General Delamain. Never fear.
Something is coming from the west. Khazreddin.
Greenmantle by John Buchan, dramatized by Patricia Hannah. Part 1, November 1915.
The sight of the name Bullivant on a telegram form carried me back 18 months to that business with German spies before the war. I hadn't seen the man since, though I had read about him in the newspapers.
Everything all right, Dick?
For more than a year, I had been a busy battalion officer. And there was no prouder man on earth than Richard Hannay when he took his Lennox Highlanders over the parapets on that glorious and bloody 25th day of September. Loose was no picnic, but it was a tea party to the show I had been in with Bullivant, when I had hunted and been hunted by agents of the Black Stone.
Well, bad news, I hope.
What's that, Sandy?
The telegram. Not bad news.
It's from Sir Walter Bullivant. He wants to see me.
Hello? Well, that means you've got the battalion. Mm. Congratulations, old fellow.
No, Sir Walter's Foreign Office. Nothing to do with straightforward fighting. Not a word from him since that 39 steps business. Now this telegram. What on earth can the Foreign Office want with an obscure major in the Lennox Highlanders?
Well, I probably heard what a good show you put on at Loos and want to give you a staff job. Oh, good Lord, Dick. You'll be a blighted brass hat stuck in an office in Whitehall.
Now I have to report to him in London in double quick time.
Corporal!
Damn. Just when things were starting to get interesting here.
If you come back, bring some marmalade from Faulkner's. That's a good fella.
London in November. Is there anything more depressing? I envy you men at the front, Major Hannay.